From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why is a game of Mahjong so crucial in Crazy Rich Asians? Then filmmaker Steve James's documentary series, America to Me, attempts to understand how race affects student performance at a progressive Chicago area high school.
I've been and I've filmed in schools where the funding is really low, where there's violence and gangs, and those are the reasons that are put forward as why there's a problem. Those things are not happening in Oak Park.
And we remember playwright Neil Simon, who died yesterday at the age of 91. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan that profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue, natgotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. The Hollywood Reporter hails it as one of TV's greatest comedies. For your Emmy consideration, nominated for 4 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. For the second straight weekend, the romantic comedy Crazy Rich Asians was number one at the box office. Warner Brothers already is developing sequels to the film, which is the first major studio release with an all-Asian cast in 25 years. About a quarter of the Crazy Rich Asians ticket buyers this past weekend were Asian Americans, and that's down from about 38% in the movie's opening weekend. As the demographics of the audience expands, that means more people might have no idea what's really going on in the film's Mahjong game. The scene is not in Kevin Kwan's novel that the movie is based on, but it figures prominently in the film. And that means that the more you know about Mahjong, the more you might appreciate some of the important nuances in how the game unfolds. For a closer reading of the Mahjong scene, I spoke with Jeff Yang. He's a co-host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce and a CNN featured contributor. And he started with a primer on the game's rules.
Four players at a time gather together, facing one another in cross shape, east, west, north, south. And each of them has tiles in their hand, 13 tiles, essentially, that they're using to construct sets or sequences, either matched, identical characters or symbols, or sequential ones in order of a suit. And the game is intensely complicated, not just because of the rules of play, which actually are fairly straightforward, but the scoring itself is just, it is something you could actually do a PhD solely on. There are so many different styles of scoring, so many different patterns that win, so many different modalities, essentially, in which you can earn points or lose points, as the case may be, that it takes a lifetime to master.
The scene in the film is not in Kevin Kwan's best-selling novel, but it plays a critical role in the narrative of the film. So without giving away too many spoilers or details, who's playing the game in the scene, and why are so many specifics of the game they're playing, like who's sitting where, the number 8, tiles representing bamboo, why are all of those little things so critical?
This is a martial arts scene. At its core, it was inspired by, actually, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. There's this rooftop fight that Michelle Yeoh is a part of in that movie that John Chu just has said in multiple interviews now was the inspiration for the way the scene flows, the pace of it, and even the sound of it.
So it's it's combat,
yes,
but with tiles.
It is tile-to-tile, head-to-head combat. But it's not just the combat or even the dialogue, which is amazing in the scene, that really matters. It's the gameplay. And they actually hired, if you will, a Mahjong choreographer to ensure that the hand would play out in a way to comment on what they're saying and end up in a certain combination, a certain circumstance that blows open the movie and changes everything and changes Eleanor's mind, basically. Some of the clear elements of symbolism that you wouldn't necessarily get if you don't know the game. When Rachel is sitting down, she's seated in what you'd call the west seat, and she invites Eleanor to sit down as the dealer, the person in control, in the east seat, right? And of course, you know, we're talking here about Rachel representing the West, America, and Eleanor representing the East, Asia, right? As they play the game, you can see that two different strategies are going on, Eleanor is trying to assemble a set of matched sets, if you will, a hand in which matched characters are the winning victory. And her whole ethos is, we need to stick together as Asians, or as people specifically of this set of wealthy, you know, Chinese, Singaporeans, what she calls Gakilang. It's a Hokkien phrase, which means one of us. And she has said to Rachel, you are not one of us. You're not Gakilang. So she's trying to create matches. She's trying to create Gakilang, right? Meanwhile, Rachel is trying to assemble a winning hand out of bamboo. Now, the bamboo suit is really kind of unique in some ways because it represents a plant that symbolizes prosperity and fortune in Chinese tradition. That's a moment where you realize that the conversation happening on the table is just as important as the conversation happening above it.
You wrote a 3,000-word article about the scene for Vox, and in reading it and thinking about watching this scene, I wondered, does the movie operate on a different level if you understand the game? Does your understanding of Mahjong affect your understanding of the film?
It absolutely does, but it's not necessary, right? And I think this is what's really powerful about how John and the creative team behind the film decided to approach this work. They knew that there was going to be aspects of this film that would appeal to or connect with people at that discrete level of uniqueness, right? But then on the other hand, there are universal human themes of love, of heartbreak, of family that work consistently regardless of whether you pick up those themes. And this scene is maybe emblematic of that.
Let me ask you one non-Mahjong question. Your son Hudson is an actor on Fresh Off the Boat, and I think you and I can easily agree that Hollywood has a terrible history casting Asian actors in lead roles, and even worse, hiring Asian writers and directors. So how important is a movie like Crazy Rich Asians?
It is unbelievably important. I think what Crazy Rich Asians does is it intersects these two tropes, this idea that Asian American actors finally are perhaps getting a chance to be seen, to be put into these opportunities, but also that our stories are being told with the specificity that will not allow them to be rewritten. And what I mean by this is, Hollywood doesn't just have a tradition of not casting Asians in non-white roles. It has a tradition of casting white actors in Asian roles. There were studios who wanted to make this film if he would recast Rachel Chu as Rachel Smith, you know, and put a white woman in that lead role. And they refused. So this is what they got. They stood their ground. And I think everything is different now.
Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, John.
You can find Crazy Rich Asians in theaters. You can find Mahjong in game stores. Coming up, documentary filmmaker Steve James spent a year inside a Chicago area public high school to examine racial disparities. In his 1994 documentary Hoop Dreams, filmmaker Steve James told the story of two Chicago high school students hoping to play college and perhaps even professional basketball. 24 years later, he's documented the lives of other Chicago area teens in his outstanding new series, America to Me. It was shot over the course of one school year at Oak Park and River Forest High School. In this scene, first-year students are greeted as school starts by cheering upperclassmen.
You always do question how people are going to see you. I am a very, very, very shy person, so that first step is really hard.
Oak Park is an economically and racially diverse school with some 3,400 students. It is also located in what's known as a progressive town, but James, who lives there and whose kids attended the school, noticed that students of color were not doing as well academically as the white kids, and that's what he set out to try to understand.
I've been and I've filmed in schools that are besieged, you know, Chicago public schools, where the funding is really low, where there's violence and gangs and extreme poverty. And oftentimes when people look in those situations and do films about them, those are the reasons that are put forward as why there's a problem. Those things are not happening in Oak Park. all the kids we followed, they're not all rich by any means. But when you eliminate those very obvious variables of barriers to education, it's like, well, what's going on in a place like Oak Park? Why can't they seem to meaningfully impact this gap? And so I don't have some prescriptive answer for you, but I think over the course of the series, I think we get at trying to understand some of what contributes to that. And also calls into question just how we define being educated in this country. And so much of it is based on empirical things like ACT scores and GPAs. And that's a game that's kind of rigged against Black kids in this country. The upper level classes are, you know, very white, and that can be very intimidating for Black students who find themselves in those classes. Upper level classes get more weighted credit for GPA than lower level classes, so that contributes to higher GPA. So, you know, one of the kids that we follow in the series and is featured very prominently in the first five episodes that we're showing here, Jada. You meet Jada. She's one of the most engaged and passionate students I've ever met. And you find out, you know, not in the first half, but in the second half of the series, that she's actually a quote-unquote gap kid. Her GPA is not that high, and her ACT scores are not that high. And by that point, you know this young woman, and you think, how can that be possible? This is a profoundly engaged and intelligent young woman. She can't be that. And so it calls into question just literally how we define it. And then how we define it is how people get to the colleges. And it just reverberates throughout the entire educational system.
And I think it would be fair to say, too, that this is a documentary that's not just looking at the struggles of African-American kids. There's a freshman, I believe, Caroline, is she a freshman, who is compulsive about her studies, potentially to the detriment of her own mental health. Could you talk a little bit about Caroline and why it was important to include her in the film as well?
Yeah, you know, at the beginning of episode five in the series, we introduced two white students. And that came about because of our own sort of growing understanding of the need to broaden our lens and not just focus on Black and biracial kids, but include white kids. And Caroline's one of them. And Caroline does represent a kind of very significant part of the Oak Park community and any community like Oak Park, where you have more affluent families who are very, very focused on their kids' education and achievement with expectations that those kids are going to go to the very best colleges in the country. And kids from Oak Park that fall into that slot do that regularly. And Caroline is one of those students. And one of the things that's not often talked about and that we get into in this is, what are the costs of high achievement, not just low achievement? And she kind of represents that.
When you're making a documentary, there's a degree of casting about figuring out who the people are that you're going to follow. You're not obviously hiring actors, but you are making a choice about which stories you're going to follow. How did you go about choosing the kids that you followed? And were there some kids you followed whose stories didn't turn out to be that interesting? And maybe some kids you met along the way who you decided to shift focus to and say, this person is somebody we should have been following from the get-go?
The latter definitely happened. You know, yeah, so John and I began this process of interviewing kids. And we probably interviewed about 40 kids and their families. I wanted to talk to both kids and their parents because I knew that we were going to want to spend time with the kids in their homes as well, not just their school life. And so we were really casting families, not just kids. And so once we narrowed down a kind of list of about, oh, I'd say about 12 or 13 kids that we thought were the best possibilities, then we brought our segment directors in. I knew that since this is going to be a miniseries, that this is not the kind of thing where I could go out and shoot it just myself. And so I brought in these incredible segment directors, Kevin Shaw, Rebecca Parrish, and Bing Liu. And so we all worked together, and we began by following about seven kids. And then along the way, we picked up another five. So we ended up following 12 kids by the time you get through the entire series.
We're talking with Steve James. His new documentary series is called America to Me. I've never forgotten something you told me 24 years ago when Hoop Dreams came out. And that was, you were following these young boys who were playing basketball, and they had a lot of home life problems. And there's a moment where one of the kids' families loses its power because they're unable to pay their electrical bill. And I remember asking you about it then, and you said it was horrible to watch, but it was great for the film.
Yeah. Does that happen in this film as well, where there are things that you know are really difficult to watch, but are going to convey the story that you want to tell, even if it means it's going to be very difficult for both the audience and maybe you as a filmmaker to experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you're going to make honest documentaries, then you have to be willing to show the truth, even when the truth, you know, isn't pretty. What I feel an obligation to, though, as a filmmaker, when it comes to situations like that, or like the portrayal of Terrence, or a kid like Kashan, who is struggling academically, that and very prominently in the series, in the first five episodes, what I feel our obligation is as filmmakers is to not hold them up for ridicule and judgment, but to try and get the audience to truly empathize and understand what they're going through and why that is. And I think that's the most important thing I can do when you're dealing with difficult subject matter.
I'm the parent of a high school student, and I was really struck by how the kids in this documentary in high school talk about race and how they segregate themselves in some ways based on their interests and activities, but also how they describe race and their attitudes about race and the kind of unconscious bias that they express. At some points, there's a girl toward the middle of the series who talks about a janitor in an incredibly offensive way to, I think, most people, but I don't think she thinks it's offensive when she says it.
No.
What did you take away from how kids, including many multiracial kids, talk about race that was new to you? What did you learn from their words and their experiences?
Well, you know, I went into making this film thinking I knew quite a bit about this topic because I've made a number of films that grapple with race. And I found out pretty quickly how little I knew, that, you know, the level of microaggressions and also the level of overt racism that still goes on in this country. When you look at the football game, where they're playing an all-white team and they are taunted racially by the white, you know.
It's a basketball game, actually.
Well, no, there's the football game.
True.
Right.
Not Fenwick,
but the football game, Hinsdale Central, right?
True.
There's racial taunting going on there, and then there's tremendous amount of class and race conscious stuff going on in the basketball game. But then there's all this sort of microaggression and the kind of stuff that many people of color wrestle with day in and day out that many of us as white people have no clue of, and even understanding of when we are engaged in doing it. And so this was a very eye-opening experience for me as a white person to really come to some understandings about what it means to have white privilege and the ways in which that is expressed and unknowingly. But the other thing that was really struck me about this is the kids we followed, they're amazing, and they're amazingly insightful. And I think we have a tendency to think, well, they're young. What could they possibly know about all this, really? And they know a lot. And they are so much smarter about everything, including race, than I was when I was, you know, 10 years older than them.
Do you think the issues facing this school are issues that every school in America is grappling with?
Absolutely. I mean, people have said to me, it's like, you know, if we had figured this out, we would have dealt with it by now. And it's true. It's not that no one cares at all, but it also is, though, a question of where the focus falls. And, you know, I think too often communities feel like if I live in a liberal community, if I send my kids to a diverse school, I'm doing what I should be doing, that I don't have any further obligations. And one of the things you're hearing more and more now from people in the black community who are activists is that it's not enough for white people to say, I'm not racist. They need to be anti-racist. They need to do more than just feel like they're not contributing to the problem, because by doing nothing, we all kind of contribute to the problem.
Steve James, great to see you.
Thank you very much, John.
The 10-part documentary series America to Me airs on the cable channel Starz. Coming up on The Frame, Neil Simon was known as a quintessentially New York storyteller, but he also had deep ties to Southern California.
K KVCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in his Emmy-nominated role as Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, one of the most influential and celebrated artists of the 20th century. Antonio and Picasso both hail from the same hometown, Malaga, Spain, where the production spent several days filming, including in the same house where Picasso was born. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information.
And the HBO drama Westworld, Time proclaims it's one of the biggest shows on Earth. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld. For your consideration, nominated for 21 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The prolific and influential playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon died on Sunday at the age of 91. He had deep personal and professional ties to New York. Simon was born in the Bronx, and many of his scripts were based in Manhattan and other boroughs. But he also had strong connections to Los Angeles, where the movie studios produced adaptations of several of his plays. And many of those plays were produced and even premiered in Southern California, mostly at the Center Theater Group's Amundsen Theater. Michael Ritchie is artistic director there, and I spoke with him about Simon's presence in L.A. I began by asking Ritchie why Simon's comedy style was so effective.
I don't think that Neil ever wrote a joke. I think he wrote comedy writ large. And what made it so successful in my mind was that he was a real craftsman at storytelling, and the storytelling came from character. I think if you go to any of his plays, to television or movies, you find that they're all driven by really cleanly and clearly defined characters who at some point are in a battle with themselves or with others, and I think that's where his comedy comes from.
I think people who know his work in theater largely and probably fairly associate him with stories set in New York. Plaza Suite, Lost in Yonkers, Barefoot in the Park. That's not Griffith Park. That would be Central Park. And yet, Brighton Beach Memoirs actually had a pre-Broadway engagement at the Amundsen Theater here in L.A. in 1982.
Right.
What did he mean to West Coast audiences, and where do you see his work fitting into what you've done at the Center Theater Group and also on the western coast of the States?
I do think he wrote urban comedy. I think it was very clearly defined, and by urban comedy, quite often it was set in New York. In apartments or, apartment houses. There were quite a number of plays of his. But I think he was writing for an urbane audience as well. And actually, there were a number of his shows that have played here over the years, including a good half a dozen, I would imagine, pre-Broadway tryouts. He actually quite enjoyed coming to Los Angeles to work on the play pre-Broadway in order to develop it. And by all reports, it was due in part to the audience that exists here. They were, and always have been, urbane, whether or not it was a New York sensibility that I think he was able to help tailor the shows through the reaction of the audiences here.
His last show at the Amundsen was the Sunshine Boys in 2013. Do you have any recollections of that production?
Oh, sure. It was terrific. We had both Danny DeVito and Judd Hirsch in it playing old vaudevillians who had a wonderful career together, had broken up and had a bitter breakup and had not seen each other for many years. And then a nephew of one of them brings them back together under the premise of one last show together. And so what was wonderful about that was, we had a bit of a Jewish vaudeville of Catskills humor that was driving it. Judd and Danny had, of course, you know, starred together on, you know, a wonderful TV series, Taxi. So to have the two of them actually coming back together to work on the stage with that behind them helped to make it special. And then for me personally, also, it was opening night and having Neil Simon both in the audience and backstage afterwards, having, you know, the man must have seen thousands and thousands of performances of his shows, and to have him so generous and enthusiastic about the production was very heartwarming to me, and certainly to both Danny and Judd.
What will you miss about him as a person and as a writer?
I was lucky enough to be around Neil on numerous occasions, personally and professionally. I did have one wonderful moment with him in New York during previews for Jake's Women. And I would arrive just as the show was going up, and the house manager would let me in and let me stand at the back of the house. During the first act, as soon as the curtain went up, Neil turned around and had his back to the audience and just looked at the back wall for the entire first act. And then when the act ended, I started chatting with him, and I finally said to him, I couldn't bear to watch it anymore. And he said, oh, no. Tonight, I just wanted to listen to the audience. And he wasn't even listening to the show. He was listening to the audience in the sense of, where were they following it? Where were they laughing? What were they getting? I found out later that in a note session, he said to the cast, the director, and particularly the actor who's delivering the lines, he said, you know, the setup line is getting a bigger laugh than the laugh line. Just cut the laugh line and let them enjoy themselves. And it was, I thought, when I talk about him as a craftsman, that is what stands out in my mind. That moment of someone not being so precious with his own words, his own wit, his own joke. He realized that he was there in service of not only the art, but also the audience. And I don't know that we see as much of that approach consistently over the years as I saw that night.
Michael Ritchie is the artistic director of the Center Theater Group. Michael, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And this Thursday night, the lights at theaters on Broadway will be dimmed in memory of Neil Simon. That's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.